Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto with a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd and solidarity with QP3902. Woo!
And I'm also solidarity with QP3902. Woo!
The University of Toronto is on strike at the moment.
Well, parts of the University of Toronto are on strike against itself.
Yes, specifically the teaching assistants are on strike against the man or the woman.
Oh, yes?
Yes.
They're taking it to the streets?
I don't know. They're fighting the administration.
Like you do.
Yeah.
You get to feel like a nice little pinko commie.
Well, it's, you know, a lot of my friends are striking and picketing and...
Yeah, it's been interesting.
Solidarity.
Because I feel like I'm trying to think of the last few strikes where I've known people involved. I guess the big municipal strike.
Yeah.
We had some friends who were involved with that. It's interesting. This one is, I've definitely seen more on Facebook and more like...
Well, I think they're working really hard on social media.
Yeah. But I haven't seen it sort of in regular media, whereas, I mean...
Well, it has been in regular media. It's just mostly been the university side as opposed to the TA side.
Ah,
and
gotcha,
so the TAs are working as much as they can to get out, like, the message.
Get the message across?
But it's interesting because the last TA strike was just a couple years before I started at U of T.
Oh, wow.
It was the strike that got us the guaranteed funding package.
Ah.
And there was an almost strike... when I was just starting my PhD, to get it raised from $12,000 a year to $15,000 a year.
Okay.
And that worked. They didn't actually strike. They negotiated that and they got it. It like gradually raised over 3 years.
Okay.
And then this is to get that funding package cost of living
increase.
That they haven't had for like 8 years.
Yay, fun.
Good times. Good times.
Indeed. So aside from your godless communism, is there anything else going on the last little bit?
Well, I guess just the sad news.
There is sad news. I guess should we jump right into things?
Yeah.
So this is going to be a fairly, I don't know, maudlin and melancholic, but hopefully also celebratory episode.
I think celebratory.
In the last week, I'd say about a week,
yeah.
we've said goodbye to a handful of friends. First off, Debs and Errol, as we announced a while back, they are parting ways, and they had their big farewell concert, and we managed to get a babysitter in so we could go out and see it. And that was really nice. That was a really sort of special time.
Oh, it was just such a good time. And they had basically like all the nerdy bands from around Ontario.
Yeah.
Like as many nerd bands from Ontario as they could find opening for them. So it was just like this geek filk... extravaganza?
No, it was a really just amazing celebration of that. And the big news from today, when we're recording this on Thursday, is the passing away of Terry Pratchett. And so we thought we would sort of, we originally were thinking of just kind of talking about Debs and Errol.
Well, music.
And music and things like that. But with this happening, it sort of dovetailed nicely, or at least sort of...
Well, I mean, it's not like Debs and Earl didn't die. Hi, Debs and Earl.
No, but...
We have enjoyed... We certainly have enjoyed them, and their music has meant a lot to us, and they've been good friends.
Yeah. And I think it's... I don't know. I think it's useful from time to time to look at these kind of, you know, partings and what it means. We talk about when shows end and things like that. But we mourn, you know, what happens to Star Wars and things like that. But this is two kind of big losses. I mean, Debs and Errol have been a huge part of this show. You know, I mean, they supported us. They gave us music. They gave us all their music to use. We had Errol on
telling
his crazy life story. And it's been interesting because we were there at the start of Debs and Errol.
Well, they got their start through your you and your friends Monkey Men Productions theater company.
Because I think they had sort of gotten together on this sort of February, February album writing month.
Oh, okay.
I think that's sort of where they kind of began collaborating, and then they first performed at the first Simian Showcase because it'd been Banana Festival the year before, which was the first year I did Ask Lovecraft. Or not SLF, I did Monsters Invisible playing Lovecraft. And then we sort of revamped and rejiggered the whole thing the following year and got them to come on board and do their particular brand of geeky music. And then they were just sort of a part of Monkey Man life for a while. They were at a bunch of our fundraisers and we, you know, collaborated with them. And it sort of it got us involved with Manda, I want to say, because she was friends with Errol. And it was a really... I don't know. It was great to have this community and to see a community form around these two people.
Yeah,
you know, because it really did sort of spring up, and they did the NaNoWriMo musical together.
Right.
Sometime during this whole thing, and I think they just managed to hit some, you know, really powerful, obvious kind of feelings and sentiment going on in Toronto and the greater Ontario area. But they had fans from all over.
But I think there was just something about their music just has so much heart and it's just so happy.
It's incredibly happy.
I mean, I think that's as much as it's geeky, it's also just fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and they come out of that folk tradition, that kind of song parody and celebration of geekiness, but they definitely had a really interesting voice. This kind of snarky, you know.
Well, it could be
back and forth, batinage.
Snarky and kind of sentimental at the same time, which, if you know anything about me, you know that is like the thing I cannot resist.
Oh,
is something
true.
That is like both sort of cynical and saccharine at the same time.
That is very true.
That is just like, I'm all over that.
Well, and seeing them perform is also, like, live is such an amazing thing. Because you get a bit of their kind of back and forth.
You don't really get their banter on the CD.
But man alive and just the
just poor Debs being tormented by Errol.
I think, definitely during the farewell concert, he tried to get a high five, a high 10, and then he, like, put his foot in her face to get a high 15, at which point I think he almost fell over if he did not, in fact, fall out of his seat.
It was awesome.
It was pretty amazing. And yeah, they just kept it up. They kept, you know, they kept up that really powerful energy that spoke to folks. And it was touching and it was silly and it was very just earnestly itself. You know, there was no sense of artifice. There was no sense of it kind of being this cynical put on thing.
Yeah.
You know, their message was sort of, I don't know, it was authentic. And, you know, we talk about this quest for what the authentic, you know, both. And we want to talk about the kind of the hipster millennial desire for authenticity, but you know, spiritually as well, you know, you're searching for something that's authentic and real, and they provided that in a really interesting and really silly way.
And community, right? That they drew people to them.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to a lot.
And they tried to build up other performers, you know, they set up this like Canadian Geek Band site and they, I don't know, they you know, working with a lot of other bands and trying to kind of organize. I mean, the fact that they had all these bands come out essentially, you know, to advertise themselves and to be, have this really huge audience. I mean, this was, you know, Errol was talking about how he, if he had known how many people were going to come to this farewell tour, he would have picked a slightly bigger venue.
It was a little crowded.
It was a little crowded. Rachel and I, like, grabbed a table.
Well, fortunately, it worked out really well because we were going to try to go early so we could get pho at the nice, like, Vietnamese place around the corner. And then due to Toronto transit being the worst.
Yes.
We ended up super late, so we couldn't get food, but that meant that we got to the venue, like, 15 minutes early.
Yeah, because, yeah, we would have used that
extra
time.
So we actually had a table.
Yeah.
And then we got expensive, but really good food, so it's all good.
Yes, it all worked out.
Man, that was good fried chicken. I just keep thinking about how good that fried chicken was.
I'm glad that you got
to have... It was so tender and crispy.
Do we need to return this to being a food podcast?
Maybe.
Okay. And it was, yeah, and it was great because it was one of those, it was one of those events where you just sort of kept seeing people that you knew, you know, like, you know, we saw some of our Monkey Men friends there, but then other folks that we'd kind of seen from the kind of theater scene, and a guy that I actually worked with at Chapters, who now has a really funny sort of comedy band and webcomic. He was out, Rock Paper Cynic, very worth checking out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was just this really great expression of love and also sadness. You know, this was their farewell concert, you know, and you know, they've only been around for I think 4 years.
Almost 4 years.
Yeah. So it was this really kind of big explosive thing that you know, and they're moving on to other projects, and I'm excited to see where that goes. But I don't know, it was a very unique point in history. You know, at least as far as
Toronto geek history. Toronto geek history.
But I don't know. I think a lot of ways it inspired us to kind of work on, you know, geeky stuff, and
yeah.
You know, this is...
Well, they certainly have been, like, as you pointed out, I mean, their music has been given us a framework for our podcast and a theme song for our podcast.
Yeah.
And so they've been fun.
They have been.
And we got their comic book.
We did. Yeah, based on their
daily webcomic.
It was part of their daily webcomic.
Yeah.
It was like the first third or quarter of their webcomic. And yeah, so that was again, sad, but celebratory. More sad, and really sad is the news about Sir Terry Pratchett, and this was.
Well, that's one of those. It's been fascinating for me all day on Facebook to just look at the number of people I know who are so moved by Terry Pratchett's death.
Yeah, when I think about, you know, the fact that we just had the big Leonard Nimoy outpouring, and you know, and I saw that and sort of. Intellectually, I could understand that this was very sad, that, you know, but, you know, he had lived a good life.
And he did not mean any, not that he didn't mean anything to me, but that was not it was not something that was part of my geek story.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, precisely. And then, you know, when the news hit today, when I heard, you know, I saw a quick, like, quote of Terry Pratchett and knew right away that what it meant.
I didn't know, because I've been in meetings all day.
Yeah.
And I had just gotten out of a 2-hour meeting when I got your text that was just saying, man, the news about Terry Pratchett is destroying me.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
He broke the news to me very hard.
Well, I didn't know if you were going to pop onto Facebook at any point because it was all over the place. But I also just, I mean, I was in tears at one point today. Like, you know, when I first saw it, it was like, okay, I'd been expecting this. He'd been sick for a long time. And so, you know, I sort of, again, intellectually understood that this is just, you know, what was, you know, kind of being planned. And with his Alzheimer's, I don't know, I feel like we've kind of been mourning him for a while. But just at one point, I was just with Amanda, and it just hit me. And it just was like I just couldn't stop crying. And I was, you know, she was sort of looking at me sort of concerned and confusedly. And it was, it just was really, really powerful. And I mean, I haven't even read a Discworld book in a while. I kept sort of meaning to, read Raising Steam and finally finish Unseen Academicals. But
there's a picture of our child putting a tiara on Chewbacca on your computer.
Oh, right. Sorry. This is our screensaver is various pictures of our daughter. So
sorry. I just thought I needed to share that with the world.
Well, strange, you know, silliness is, I think, in the midst of sadness is what Terry Pratchett would approve of.
So what should we do for this Terry Pratchett retrospective?
Well, I guess we can talk about, we've talked a little bit about Pratchett, but we've never done a full Discworld episode.
No, we haven't.
In all of our kind of geekiness, I think we haven't. I sort of went and did a cursory search to make sure.
I don't remember ever doing that.
I think we've talked about some of the movies and things.
I'm sure.
But I guess, let's talk about how we came to discover Terry Pratchett.
I think you should go first.
I found out about him in high school. A friend of mine... I'm trying to remember who. One of my high school friends just lent me, had a bunch of his books and just started lending them to me. And I was lucky enough that I actually sort of read them in relative order. Like, I think I read Color of Magic first and then Light Fantastic and sort of working my way through, which is really good because early Terry Pratchett is really rough. And going back to it after reading his later stuff is really, really hard. I remember trying to reread Equal Rights after the 15th book was out or something like that, and just finding it almost unreadable. And luckily, the Tiffany Baking books came out, and they sort of did... they covered some of the similar ground as Equal Rights. But even just today, and again, I haven't.
I still don't think I've read Equal Rights.
I don't know.
I should.
I don't know if it's one we have.
But we have all of them.
But even today, I just pulled out Reaper Man, which really was my, I called it my favorite for a long, long time, but I haven't read it since probably 99 or 2000. And just started reading it through. And again, it just, it hit me, you know, just that wave of such wonderful, whimsical writing, which is, you know, which is, again, it grabbed me as a kid. You know, it was silly. It had that kind of British, you know, quirkiness to it. But there's also nothing quite like it. I mean, I'd read The Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, by this point. And so that was the closest thing I could really compare it to, you know, this sort of slightly surreal kind of describing things in an almost sing-songy nonsense way. And it definitely had some spike and some sarcasm to it, but it certainly wasn't as cynical as The Hitchhiker's Guide was. And I don't know, it just, it, you know, I devoured it. I mean, I remember just going through and reading. But I'm trying to remember what all was out by that point. I think Last Continent or Interesting Times was one of the, you know, the newest books by the time I was reading. And like Jingo and things like that. Because then, and by the time we got to college and we met, I think, I'm trying to remember if this was something I tried to evangelize or if Tom.
I think it was ultimately Tom was the one who got me on the death books.
Yes.
Because my friend in high school, or middle school, really, my friend Rachel.
Other Rachel. One of the many Rachels.
Gave me a copy of Weird Sisters.
Okay.
And I feel like I just never read it.
Hmm.
Or like I started it, but I didn't finish it. But it was really in college. Tom got me on. I think Soul Music was actually the first one I read.
Didn't I try to get you to read like Jingo first or something?
Maybe.
I wouldn't have given you Jingo.
I don't think so.
But I feel like someone handed you Jingo at one point, and like this is dumb.
I don't know. But Soul Music was definitely the first one I read all the way through.
Yeah.
And and it's funny because I can remember this friend of mine, and I mean, you know Rachel.
Yeah.
Was one of our oldest friends,
mm-hmm.
reading Soul Music in like middle school. Like I remember her reading Terry Pratchett. I just didn't read it myself.
Yeah.
But it was in college. Tom got me to read Soul Music. And then I read, I went back, I think, and read Mort and Reaper Man. And it was really the death books. And then I read The Witches.
Yeah.
And actually, like, I came into The Guards much, much later.
Mm.
Like, and it's funny because I feel like the Guards and the Ankh-Morpork stuff is what's really taken off in the later.
Definitely. Yeah,
in the later books, especially with, like, Sam Vimes. But a piece of me will all, like, I love the death books.
They're amazing.
I love Susan. My favorite of the books is Thief of Time.
Yeah, Thief of Time is pretty amazing.
And well, I think because it gets into me like philosophically and the Aurors and this whole idea of order and
the auditors and like, their awfulness.
Sorry, the auditors. Of course, it's the auditors. Aurors. I'm
spilling some Harry Potter into this.
Anyway, they always sort of reminded me of the auditors, but the auditors and that idea of time and order and. I don't know. It was very cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Pratchett books definitely you can kind of look at them and I mean they bounce around between their different subject matters, but I think like you know the early stuff was very Rincewind heavy.
Yeah.
Was very that kind of like silly. We're going to take you through these various fantasy tropes, Conan the Barbarian, like kind of.
Well, and you can see like almost stages in his career, yeah. Right? Like so, the early books, yeah, very Rincewind heavy, very much just silly, zany satire. And then you kind of got in the midsection, which was fairly death and witches heavy, I feel.
Yes.
That's sort of where Guards comes in.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, these things all sort of bleed into each other.
And where you start getting, I would say, a more sophisticated kind of satire. And more like just starting to get into some richer characters. And then you get into his later. I would say Thief of Time is probably one of the like the
cutoff points.
Not cutoff points, but like liminal books, right? I think after that is when you start getting into books that are actually like these are like real novels.
well, they
and especially with I think Sam Vimes is a huge part of that.
Sam Vimes definitely takes off, and well, it's I remember reading some sort of essay at some point about sorcery being a, you know, like a kind of one of these liminal books.
Okay.
Like, you can sort of look at all the books before sorcery as being these fairly kind of standalone-ish, silly, you know, like, there's no set kind of mythology. There's no real world building. He's just, you know, there's the luggage and there's silliness and there's Rincewind and oh, here's death. And then sorcery kind of changes a lot of things.
Mm.
And immediately after sorcery, you get Mort and Weird Sisters.
Okay.
And by the time, and Mort, for me, that's the one I always recommend to people. Mm. Like, I feel like that's the one you can get folks, you can get a lot of buy-in on. Weird Sisters did the thing of, it did the time jump. So it sort of took us out of the kind of the early years and into the sort of the Ridcully Vimes era of Ankh-Morpork. And yeah, so it's I mean, it was almost like a reboot, but but you know, but and sorcery did a bit of that too. I think sorcery like wound up like killing off like all the wizards, or doing some big kind of thing. You know, again, sort of a slightly rebooting, but again, but the whole point of this essay was looking at the fact that he's, you know, you're starting to have an actual world.
Oh, okay.
You're going from just sort of like, oh, here's a place where my jokes exist, and ha ha ha, and here's a joke, and here's a joke, to oh wait, I've kind of established a place with a real history, and it's not just like, oh, here's like the silly Hollywood place, and oh, here's the silly, like, you know, pyramids, you know, kind of like, I want to do
Ponder Stibbins. Sorry, that just reminded moving pictures just reminded me of Ponder Stibbins.
Yeah.
We might have to talk about favorite characters.
We might. And
do you want to finish your train of thought first?
But yeah, but I think there are definitely these sort of moments. And then for me, the like, I feel that Night Watch.
That's probably his best book.
Yeah, I think you can see the sort of upward trajectory, and then you hit Night Watch, and Night Watch. I think it's because I'm such a big Les Mis fan, but Night Watch just hits this beautiful, beautiful just crescendo of feeling and emotion, and the books that follow after are fun, and I liked the Moist von Lipwick books, but there was something about Night Watch that I feel like I've not seen. It's you know, it's the civil campaign of Ratchet, right? Yeah. Like, it hits, you know, everything kind of gets you to that point, and it just bam is amazing, and everything after is enjoyable, but it's, you know, sort of has a kind of. Just there's it's, it doesn't meet up to it, so there's not I don't know, there's just there, it doesn't quite resonate or have the same kind of weight as as that one.
I agree.
So, favorite characters.
Well, Ponder Stibbins.
Okay.
We have to. I mean, I don't know that I would necessarily call him one of my favorite characters, but just the concept of Ponder, where you have this like. I just love the scene in Moving Pictures where I don't even remember the name of the other guy. The main guy in Moving Pictures who was so lazy that he wanted to stay in school because he had, like, a trust fund that would continue to pay for
as
him
long as he was in school.
So but he had, like, perfected the ability to, like, fail his exams but not fail them so badly that he got kicked out of Unseen University.
Yes.
So that the professors gave him like the test that he had to pass or fail, which was just what is your name? But Ponder Stibbins got it by mistake. And so he was writing Ponder Stibbins. Ponder looked around. Everyone else was still furiously writing. My name is Ponder Stibbins. And everyone else was still writing. Yay, though, for Ponder Stibbins is my name. And so he passed his exams with the highest, like, with a 100%, which was unheard of. So he became, like, a full-fledged
faculty
member.
In his 20s.
But then he kind of develops into this, like, character who actually is the most, professionally competent of all the wizards.
He becomes their IT crowd,
yeah,
right?
Basically.
He becomes their IT department and is trying to, you know, whenever Pratchett wants to make a joke about sort of, you know, the sad, competent techie in the, you know, awful administration who's actually getting stuff done. And by getting stuff done is making everyone upset because he's too efficient.
Yeah.
And it's ruining their their good times. Ponder Stibbins is a lot of fun. the librarian.
Oh, yeah.
The librarian's a lot of fun. And, you know, I started with Rincewind, and I do really, really like Rincewind.
You do love Rincewind.
Rincewind just has that.
You got to play Rincewind.
I got to play a lot of people in that play. We'll touch on my my extracurricular connections with Discworld. But I mean, Vimes is I love watching that story, and I love watching where he goes in it. But for me, Death is just one of the best just characters. This sort of deity-like figure, and
anthropomorphic personification.
The anthropomorphic personification of Death with his sidekick, the Death of Rats. But again, he's this almost like, you know, passive, you know, looking from above deity, and yet not, like, he's, you know, a sort of functionary and bureaucrat, and he has to abide by these rules. I don't know, it's one of these very fascinating characters
it's the past tense. I suggest you get used to it.
Yeah, that was what I posted when I saw when I saw the news. Well, yeah, precisely. Just that kind of stentorian, yet still a touch of humor, you know, in behind the blue explosions in his eyes. I don't know. I mean, it's why I'm going back to Reaper Man, because it's the one that most, you know, quote unquote, humanizes him, or at least like explores what Death kind of.
Well, I love the scene where Death is trying to get a job, and they ask if he has any like skills. And a certain familiarity with gardening implements. That's one of my favorite lines. Although my favorite line will always be like, one of the scenes with the Death of Rats, where he's dealing with the sad little rat that just died, and squeak, the rat said, squeak, the Death of Rats confirmed.
Squeak.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, that's for me, I love Death. I mean, what was it? There was Eric, which was Pratchett's bizarre kind of Faust parody.
Mm.
Death shows up in that when the devil is chasing after Rincewind and this little guy. And so he knows that Rincewind has either gone to the beginning of time or the end of time. And he goes to the end of time, and there he sees Death just sort of sitting in the inky blackness. He's like, excuse me, have you seen someone? I've seen everyone. I mean, recently. No. Well, there's this wizard I'm looking for. Death, if he had eyes, they would have widened. Rincewind! And just moments like that just have stuck with me, you know, for so long.
For me, it's Susan. I love Susan.
Well, Susan's...
She's so Susan is Death's adopted daughter.
Granddaughter.
Death's adopted granddaughter. Yes, because she is Mort's child.
And his adopted daughter, yes.
Little Susan Death, as Tom liked to call her. And she's just this fascinating girl who kind of, like, resents Death and resents her legacy, yet at the same time embraces it.
Well, she's one of this...
Is so eminently practical.
Yeah. You know, I think Pratchett has certain types he goes back to, and I think the, like, lethally practical women and sort of, like, bizarre, you know, kind of daydreaming-ish sort of goofy guys who are kind of kicking against a father figure. I think those are two of his sort of, you know, goes back to.
But I love the just, like, not allowing the children she is governessing to get away with adorable lisps.
Yes. You know, not dissuading them that there are monsters, just teaching them how to fight back against the monsters.
Yes, precisely. So Susan is great.
She is great.
She gets to be Death for a little while.
Yes. Well, and again, she inherits qualities of Death in a sort of interesting way, and they play out in fun books. I mean, she's only in, what, four of the books?
Yeah.
Because she's in Soul Music.
Soul Music. Hogfather. Hogfather, Thief of Time. Is she only in three?
Oh, maybe she's only in three, then.
Is she in... For some reason, she's not in Masquerade.
No.
No, I don't know why.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, for those who are just listening to us without a clue, I mean, Pratchett bounces around between a couple of different genres within his world. And I think it's very clever because it allows him to not get too kind of trapped in one particular story. You know, you've got the early kind of just, you know, D&D parodies, you know, sword and sorcery parodies. Then you have the witch books, which are sort of his way of exploring different stories. Like yeah. he does
Phantom of the Opera.
He does his Phantom of the Opera episode or book. He does his Macbeth one, yes. which is that's Weird Sisters, which they made a very bizarre movie for. One of the two animated movies that we own was Soul Music and Weird Sisters. He did one of my favorites, his Midsummer's Night Dream parody, Lord and Ladies. You know, I absolutely love it. It has the most honest depiction of elves ever.
It's just terrible.
Precisely. And he has and his Phantom one where, you know, you can tell that the person leaving these notes is insane because they write out all their who exclamation
spells?
Mark.
Oh, and also like, who spells a maniacal laugh? He spelled a maniacal laugh. Who spells a maniacal laugh? Good stuff.
And then you have, and then the Renzo books eventually sort of turn into travelogues as he's like, let me go and make fun of China and Australia and the like.
Yeah.
And the wizards, I guess there's not one that's like totally wizards. That's sort of the just poking fun like, at academia.
Yeah, I feel like the Unseen Academicals is one of the only ones I can think of that's just purely set.
With the wizards,
and maybe that's why it doesn't really work, right? Like maybe the wizards can't really hold a whole book of their own.
Well, and
if anyone out there likes Unseen Academicals,
Moving Pictures is a lot of the Unseen Academicals.
I guess
that's a big chunk of the university and whatnot. The librarian can do a lot of heavy lifting,
yeah,
both narratively and literally. And then the Vimes books, which started kind of halfway through, you know, are these what I would consider the most standard kind of fantasy, urban fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of a mixture of politics and a mixture of adventure and mystery. And kind of at the end of each one, Vimes gets some kind of promotion,
yeah.
which is a mixed blessing.
Well, I feel like we have to talk about Vimes, right? Because when it comes to, I mean, the Moist von Lipwig books are fun.
And they've taken over in recent years.
They have. Although what's the most recent one where Vimes is off at like his
snuff?
That's the one where Vimes is off in like his country cottage.
Yeah. That's the with like the weird, like the kind of the paddle boat, steamboat stuff and drug smuggling. I
enjoyed that one.
It was okay. I found Vimes's voice in that one to be, I just felt very off. It felt different from other previous books.
Anyway, so Moist is fun, but like going postal is fantastic.
Yeah. He finally got the voice of that sort of, you know, young rake kicking against a father figure, which had been there since Pyramids.
Yes.
And, you know, Moving Pictures and even the amazing Maurice and his educated rodent. I mean, I feel like there is just this guy who is kind of a con artist or kind of a schlumpf who, you know, makes it good in the end.
So Vimes. Or do we need to talk about the patrician?
Well,
I feel like it kind of goes with Vimes, but
it really does. I mean, the city, the main city where most of the action takes place is this kind of
pseudo... Oh, and Cut Me on Throat Dibbler and Captain Carrot.
There's a lot of characters, Rachel.
There's so many. It's the best.
But the sort of this kind of pseudo London he has is Ankh Morpork, this sort of giant sluffy city just full of ridiculousness where, you know, crime is legal as long as the thieves leave a receipt. And it's all run by the patrician, you know, and it's a democracy. One man, one vote. He's the man, he has the vote. And the patrician, Lord Vetinari, is one of these great kind of pseudo-villainous characters, you know, kind of sort of lawful evil, but in a great way.
I love him.
Very, very Shere Khan from the Tailspin.
Yes,
and it's sort of villainously practical. You know, willing to kill who it takes to keep order and keep things, you know, running. But recognizes virtue and recognizes the place of virtue, and therefore you've got someone who's just brutally honest and down to earth as Sam Vimes. Sort of finds a way to use him to actually keep things going. And it works really well. Like, those books are just really fun and well-crafted. And Vimes, you know, who starts off as just this kind of schlumpy, sad, you know, night watchman, kind of drunk, slowly turns into this real, powerful kind of force for good. It resonates.
Thanks to Lady Sybil.
That's right. Well, it resonates a bit with, I think, the Vorkosigan's books, right?
Yeah.
You know, where he sort of Miles kind of like... slowly comes more and more into his own, and you sort of see him get more and more responsibilities and leveling up as he goes. I think there's a parallel there.
Yeah.
And it just works. And he also has darkness that Pratchett's sort of willing to explore and play with. And I don't know. Vimes is definitely probably his most complex character.
Oh, sir. Well, that's what I think makes Nightwatch work, right?
Yes.
Is that Vimes is, I think, the most psychologically fully realized person. Right? Because so many of, as wonderful as so many of Pratchett's characters, I mean, we haven't even talked about the witches. How have we not talked about Nanny Ogg and Granny Weatherwax?
There's a lot of characters.
I'm just saying, these, like, and Granny Weatherwax, who is just, like, crusty and crotchety and brilliant. But, I mean, she's not necessarily a psychologically realized, like, believable human being.
No.
Right? And I would say Sam Vimes is maybe the only person in Discworld who fits that description.
Well, he gets enough screen time that you're able to see so many angles to him and see him develop in ways you don't really see a lot of the other characters develop. You know, Rincewind stays sort of a goofy coward the entire time. You know, Moist takes on more responsibilities, but he's still kind of
the same. And he matures a bit, but he's still fundamentally
the same.
Whereas
Sam Vimes, you really see...
You just see such an evolution of his character.
Yeah.
I think you're right, that everyone else, like, fits a particular role in this universe, and they don't really change too much.
No.
I mean, I'd say the Guards books, you probably see the most overall... maturity in the most number of characters.
Yeah, well, and
the various officers, but I think fundamentally it's Vimes is where you get, like, he is a person, he is complex, he is multifaceted, and he changes, and that's what makes Nightwatch so interesting, is that you have, you know, a somewhat more mature Sam Vimes looking at his younger self.
Yeah.
Right? And so you see the disparity of the character right there.
Well, and Nightwatch also has a great villain who's used very, like, he's not in there a lot, but he's just cold and scary enough in a way that, like, Tia Taima really was. Like, Tia Taima was, you know, and the Auditors. I mean, the villains that they kind of go through, they're fun. They're not... hugely memorable, I'd say.
Despite the fact that I forgot their names, I do like the Auditors. Well, I think that was fairly creepy in Thief of Time.
Yeah. No, it definitely was. And he goes back to the Auditors and plays
that whole
with the
idea of trying to, of stealing your time and
trying to freeze
everything, right? And that sense of because they want order as opposed to chaos.
Yeah. But, like, you know, the things from the dungeon dimension. Which are you know, the sort of the Lovecraftian horrors and whatnot. Actually, you know what? No, I'd say the best villain is probably the dude in Gods and Small Gods.
Mm.
He's really good. Like, I mean, it plays, I think, into a lot of Pratchett's, you know, issues with religion and with sort of false piety.
Well, and I mean, I think that's one thing that we can talk about is, I mean, I think it's fair for us to bring up Terry Pratchett's atheism.
Yeah.
And what... how that played into his writing.
Yeah, and
because he certainly is, I mean, he is very, very critical of religion.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout the books, particularly, is it Omism? The one that's, like, clearly a parody of Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Omniism,
or, and everyone is just incredibly pious and...
Yeah.
Always trying to convert everyone else.
And not willing to convert the unbeliever with convincing pamphlets or whatever the guy's name was.
Exactly. I mean, he's very critical of it.
Oh, yeah.
And there's very much the, like, in the sense of death, right? This idea that everyone gets whatever they believe is coming to them.
Yeah.
So if, you know, you believe that you're going to hell, you... Go to hell. And
if you're a horrible tyrant who believes that he's done good and goes to heaven, then that's where he goes. And there's
an injustice to it, but
and it's interesting the times that he sort of touched on faith in really powerful ways. I want to say it's Granny Weatherwax gives this sort of big speech to this little kind of traveling missionary guy, you know, who's sort of, I guess, the limp-wristed kind of, like, well, you know, it's all sort of metaphor and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And she's just like, no, you know, like, if you believe in something, you know, if you believe in a God that is father and mother, then you kill and you burn for that God.
Right.
And there's just these interesting moments where you kind of wonder, oh, you know, is Pratchett, is he sort of looking for something that again, you don't want to say, oh, you know, he was in deathbed confessions and, oh, he was secretly wanting to be Christian.
No, and I think you have to, as it's the height of disrespecting Terry Pratchett's memory to not take his beliefs on their own terms, right? From everything, and I didn't ever read The Nation, but apparently that was quite a screed against religion. But, I mean, so I think, you know, we have to accept that, you know, this was his belief system and this is what he thought. And how does that come across in his writing? And as much as we love the worlds that he creates and the ideas that he is dealing with, I think it's fair for us to kind of figure out how they do or don't resonate with the perspective that we're bringing to it.
No, that's very true.
I think that honors him more so than
trying to dig. Yeah. No, I think that's very fair. I feel it's nuanced. Yeah. I feel
absolutely, right?
There's this not just, oh, religion is obviously sort of hokum and offers nothing to no one. So, you know, like it's there's a nuance and there's something, I don't know, there's something very interesting that I picked up on even, you know, as a young person reading it.
Well, I think it's that sense of respect, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, you know, you would come across in his writing is respect for real, honest belief and honest engagement, right? And not this sense of just a smug arrogance in our relationship to our faith or a pietistic approach to our faith or a milquetoasty approach to our faith, right?
Well, it's that authenticity, right?
That quest for authenticity and the real, I think if there's something that his atheism can show us is that, you know, the actual, how hard faith is and how much our faith actually does demand of us.
Yeah.
That maybe those of us who are too close to it forget all the time and forget the actual, like, what our faith really, you know, how our faith really does compel us or how our faith really does challenge us.
Yeah.
And I think that's worth engaging with, right? And sometimes it takes someone from outside of your
bubble,
your bubble, right, to call you on it, for lack of a better word.
No, I think that's really fair.
I think that's a way to honor Terry Pratchett from his own perspective, but still see what he can,
how he can
speak to us. Yeah,
no, definitely.
We haven't talked about Whimsical Footnotes yet.
Oh, man alive. This is definitely what began my love affair with Whimsical Footnotes.
Followed up by Jonathan Strange and Mr. Gnarl and Fitzpatrick's War.
Yeah. Yeah, I just love it. I love when people put whimsical footnotes in things that are silly and kind of at odds with the text. And just, it makes me happy and gives me warm fuzzies. So I should say my connections to Pratchett outside of the books. First off, I was addicted to the Discworld MUD for the longest time and used to play that constantly. You know, get up my Telnet client and dial in and run around the Stohelet and Stolat Plains and have adventures, killing rats and trying to, you know, sell things to cut me on throat Dibbler, hanging outside the Mended Drum. And I was I produced and was in a very strange production of Mort.
I have to tell this part of the story because I was on the Kenyon College Dance and Drama Club executive when you proposed Mort.
Well, one of the times I proposed
Mort. Okay. All I'm saying is that we were going through the people submitting shows for the next season, and the president at the time said, and we have this request from Levin for a play called Mort. I guess it's some French play about death. I was like, no, not exactly. But then they did it!
Well, what happened was, because someone else was at that meeting, which was Keeley Curtis.
Oh, yes.
And this was, so I was abroad. I was in London my junior year. And when I came, and at some point, Keeley got in touch with me. I was like, Lehman, I saw that you had put forward this thing about Terry Pratchett's Mort. Is there an actual play, or are you just being stupid? I'm like, no. There's an Stephen Briggs. There's this guy who's gone through and adapted. Because every year for the club, I would submit King Ubu is King by Alfred Jarry and Mort. Those are the two things I would always suggest that we do. And she was not going to have the Kenyon College Dance and Drama Club do Mort. That would be ridiculous. But she wanted to independently do it. And they had just converted this bank building into a little, like, black box theater.
Yes.
So we decided to try to do Terry Pratchett's Morse. And it was ridiculous.
It was so much fun.
It was crazy. And because it's like, the play is written very well. It's written for a very bare bones, minimalistic interpretation, as small a cast as they can do it. And the sort of the note said, look, if you can do this with better special effects, if you have the money for that, then you can figure out what better special effects you want. We're going to assume that you have like a flashlight and finger puppets. And so we did it. And so we did it. And it was this, even with like doubling and tripling people, it was going to be this huge cast. And people just kept dropping out. And as they dropped out, I picked up their roles. So I think at the start, I was just going to be Mort's dad. But then we lost our Renswin, so I had to be a Renswin. And then we lost who did we lose? We lost like the evil Duke, so I had to be him. And just sort of picking up as it went along.
Oh, but isn't there like a really romantic story about that play where like the two people playing death, like there was a girl on a guy's shoulder, and did they end up married?
Well, what happened was that, so for death, you have this just person in a robe and then someone off stage sort of speaking into a microphone. And we picked like the shortest person to be death. So we had to like figure out like, you know, we had to do all sorts of crazy things with stilts and whatnot. But yeah, she played this girl played death, and the guy who was the voice of death, the two of them started dating, I think, during that process. Yeah, and they got married. And so that was really, that was a bizarre thing to have happen. But it was fun, and it was crazy, and it was, you know, as bizarre as you would hope a Discworld play would be. And actually, for a couple of years at the Toronto Fringe here, there's been a company that's been doing outdoor productions of Pratchett plays. I think they did Mort, and they did maybe Lords and Ladies or some of the other ones. So there's a bunch of stage adaptations of the plays, because I guess theater nerds are also nerds.
Truth.
So, yeah. I think
so we love Terry Pratchett.
We love him a lot.
It's very sad. He died of Alzheimer's or some
or complication,
other...
complications.
Some other degenerative condition that...
Well, because he'd had a stroke a few years back. And again, this is... We've known about this, that he'd been in ill health for a long time. But
read some Terry Pratchett. Read Good Omens that he wrote with Neil Gaiman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His stuff I think that's where, which they're working on. Like, that's, like, the radio play of that, I think, is finally kind of coming out. But he's an eminently charming person. If you can find footage of him talking, I remember on my random, like, DVDs of soul music, they had, like, this great, like, half an hour, an hour-long interview with him. It was, like, I'd never seen him before. This was a pre-YouTube time.
Yeah.
So it was the first time I'd seen him speak with his strange little voice and his little beard. And it was magical. And Pratchett, Pratchett managed to capture this amazing blend of humor and fantasy that he's the type of author who makes it really hard to read
mediocre
fantasy
mediocre satire, right?
Yeah.
And I'm looking over at our shelf, and Terry Pratchett takes up a shelf and a half on a Billy bookcase.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we like Terry Pratchett here.
I even have his GURPS Discworld game. I have the Bizarre Science of Discworld books, which were...
I have Nanny Ogg's cookbook.
We do have Nanny Ogg's cookbook. And which will be, I think, probably the picture for this episode, Amanda with the Unseen University cutout.
Oh, we still need to make that!
Which I think I got for you as like a present, like, years ago.
I just didn't ever get around to putting it together, because I don't do things. But
so
will finally put that together.
Now we can get out our X-Acto knives and make that as a tribute.
Okay.
But farewell to Mr. Pratchett, to Sir Terry Pratchett, for all you've done, and farewell to Debs and Errol. We're going to actually, the song we're going to go out on is Geek Love Song. Which would have been their final song, but then we demanded an encore, so they did a song after that. But nevertheless, is still one of their, I realize we don't ever play that song because it's always their intro.
Yeah, but it's really lovely.
So we're going to do that, and... let us know. Come to the site and drop off some comments. Let us know about what your experience with Pratchett's been. Tell us if you've never read Terry Pratchett. If you're interested in it, we'd love to talk with you about it, because he really is one of those important folks. So that's going to be it from us, from the world of faith, family, and fandom in no particular order. Geek out, y'all.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Ich liebe dich is German geeky for the board games. In Latin and in Spanish it is te amo. Mielina Sina is the phrase in Tokipo. Name amas fin in Esperanto.
Lina Melet.
In Sindarin means I sing because I love you.
Agi Uki is what you type
for a lion and a whore to talk to.
To stick with Elvish, we have Che Milane, yet another language that Tolkien made. Ustan, Sindrik, Ilta, spoken in Drowish, a D&D type of elf you played.
I love you, I would date with you by Tatawaki Kuno. Not a different language, but it's good enough. Hato Daisuki is Japanese by geeky, cause otaku really love their weird stuff.
Eep, off, pork,
from Saturday morning cartoons.
Aye, of yay,
from way back when I was in grade 2.
Wanai Ryan, Aroaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon it's Kapaha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikartelegar that awesome is Mandalorian, in another galaxy long gone by. If you speak Hatties, you say Umajimuna, on Dagobah it's
love you, do I?
10 print, I love you, 20 go to 10,
my first program as a child.
I pointer method love parameter you.
I bet your hormones are going wild.
You can have love, K, thanks, bye.
I display lol cat finery.
I less than 3 you and
0101010110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110110
without spaces.